Hello and welcome to Iris and the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, the Courier, for Wednesday, June 29th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Taking a look at the weather forecast, plan on a sunny and warm Wednesday. Highs will reach 90 across much of the area, along with a southwest breeze. Plan on more of the same tomorrow. By Friday, a cold front moves in and should at least provide a chance of scattered showers and storms. Behind this cold front, look for high pressure to provide dry and quiet conditions for both Saturday and Sunday. Unfortunately, trends continue to favor this high pressure system moving away from us on the 4th, which will probably open the door for a chance of scattered storms. At this time, it's too early to determine timing or possible impacts to fireworks displays. On the front page today, we have these four articles. Reynolds, Restore Heartbeat Bill. Bitcoin Mining Request Denied. 8 over 80 Winners Honored. And Trump Dismissed Threats, aide says. Let's begin with the top story about Governor Reynolds' request. Dateline Des Moines. Abortions would be illegal in Iowa once a fetal heartbeat can be detected at 6 weeks, often before a woman knows she's pregnant. Under a pair of requests, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said Tuesday she plans to submit to Iowa courts. The Republican governor announced that in the wake of last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that overturned Roe v. Wade and repealed a woman's right to have an abortion under the federal Constitution, she will ask the Iowa Supreme Court to rehear a recent case on abortion regulations so the state court can establish what legal standards can be applied to abortion restrictions in Iowa. And Reynolds said she will ask the state courts to lift an injunction on the so-called fetal heartbeat law that was passed in 2018, but immediately stopped by the courts. The legal landscape for abortion regulations has been rewritten over the past 2 weeks in Iowa and across the country. On June 17th, the Iowa Supreme Court overturned its own 2018 decision that had declared the right to an abortion was protected by the Iowa Constitution. Exactly 1 week later, on June 24th, the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the landmark 1973 decision that had made abortion access a federal right. Those rulings cleared the way for Iowa Republicans to enact stronger abortion restrictions in the state. Quote, "Now is the time for us to stand up and continue the fight to protect the unborn," Reynolds said in a statement. Quote, "The U.S. Supreme Court's historic decision reaffirms that states have the right to protect the innocent and defenseless unborn. And now it's time for our state to do just that. As governor, I will do whatever it takes to defend the most important freedom there is, the right to life," unquote. For now, abortion remains legal in Iowa until 20 weeks of pregnancy. Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller, a Democrat, announced he will not be involved with the state's request to the courts, citing his support for the legal rationale that the U.S. Supreme Court applied to Roe v. Wade in 1973 and Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 1992, which affirmed Roe. Miller also recused himself from arguing the state's defense of the 2018 fetal heartbeat law that Reynolds is now asking the courts to allow to be enforced. Quote, "In that case, I stated that I could not zealously assert the state's position because of my core belief that the statute, if upheld, would undermine rights and protections for women," Miller said in a statement. Quote, "In my nearly 40 years in office, I have declined to represent the state in only one other similar situation. I do not take lightly my responsibility to represent the state," unquote. Reynolds said the state will instead be represented by Alan Ostergren, a conservative lawyer and president and chief counsel of the Kirkwood Institute, a think tank. Reynolds's office said Ostergren will be retained at no cost to Iowa taxpayers. The top Republican leaders in the Iowa legislature, Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer from Ankeny and House Speaker Pat Grassley from New Hartford, added statements of support for Reynolds's request to the court. Quote, in 2018, the heartbeat bill created significant momentum across the country for conservative states to initiate legislation to protect the unborn. One of those state laws led to the historic Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization decision by the U.S. Supreme Court last week, opening the path for the 2018 law to be implemented in Iowa, Whitford said in a statement. Quote, I support the decision to put these laws back in front of the court to protect life here in Iowa. Zach Walls, leader of the Iowa Senate Democrats from Coralville, in a statement warned that Republicans' actions will be dangerous to the health of Iowa women. Quote, Iowa Republicans will not stop until they have completely banned abortion without exception. This is an incredibly dangerous action that threatens the health, safety, and future of Iowa women, Walls said. Reynolds's request to rehear Planned Parenthood v. Reynolds is designed to get the Iowa Supreme Court to rule what standard, if any, should be applied to abortion regulations under the Iowa Constitution. In its momentous June 17th ruling, the state court failed to establish such standards, citing a desire to first wait for the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling on Dobbs. The Iowa Supreme Court, in its June 17th ruling, said the, quote, undue burden standard that was the previous standard would remain in effect until the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling, which came a week later. Reynolds noted the undue burden standard was used by the Iowa Supreme Court in 2015 when it struck down a law banning telemedicine abortion services. Quote, thus, while the Iowa Supreme Court's decision was a step in the right direction, it left more work to be done in Iowa's courts to fully protect the life of the unborn, as the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Dobbs that states have an important interest in doing, unquote, Reynolds said in a news release. Quote, Governor Reynolds fully intends to do that work, unquote. Our next story was filed by Maria Cooper. Black Hawk County denies request for Bitcoin data center. Dateline Waterloo. The request for a Bitcoin mining site in Black Hawk County was stopped in its tracks Tuesday by the Board of Supervisors. The four members of the board present for the meeting unanimously voted against an ordinance to rezone property from an agricultural land use to a commercial manufacturing district. Supervisor Tom Little was absent. J.P. Barrick, the CEO of North Carolina-based Mining Store, is on a mission to construct a data center at 8226 West Griffith Road in Hudson after success with a mining site in Grundy County that makes about $32,000 a day, according to the Gazette. Bitcoin mining works like this. Computers calculate complex mathematical equations to confirm Bitcoin transactions, similar to how a bank confirms payments by a person to a store. These transactions form blocks, and as they are confirmed by the computer miners, it creates a blockchain, currently worth about $200,000. Although the site makes thousands of dollars a day, the daily power bill exceeds $5,000, according to the Gazette. The article states an average home uses about 11,000 kilowatt hours of electricity per year. The mining site uses about 54 million kilowatt hours a year, using the amount of electricity needed to power about 4,900 homes, equal to 95% of households in Grundy County. The number of computers at the site requires multiple fans to cool down the facility from the about 90-degree temperature. The heat and sound of the fans were a main concern to the residents next to the potential site. Barrick said the fans create 80 decibels of sound from 35 feet away, similar to the sound of a washing machine. Resident Joni Snyder said she visited the site and took videos of the sound from right next to the building to a half a mile away. Supervisors and people attending the meeting were surprised at the level of the sound. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, noise above 70 decibels over a prolonged period of time can damage your hearing. The sound can be compared to anything from city traffic inside a car to a gas-powered lawnmower. Barrick said these concerns were valid and noted he would minimize the sound by installing sound deadening vents and keeping the fans and computers clean. Residents were also worried about the effects of the heat emitted from the data center. Barbara Glasner's family owns a farm near the site. Glasner expressed fear that the temperatures would create a microclimate which would lure insects and potentially damage crops. She was also worried the warmth would attract wild animals during the cold winter. Every resident who spoke to defend their properties said the farmland is not a place for the data center. Instead, they suggested, it would be a better fit in an industrial park. The proposed area is 0.96 acres, which Barrick said limits agricultural land use and keeps costs low. Quote, I understand his concern. You're getting the best that he can do for his company so he can make the most profits, Glasner said. That's what business is about. It's minimizing your costs to maximize your profits. But that's also what agriculture is about, unquote. Barrick added that the project would create economic vitality in the community by generating cash flow. He related it to Blackhawk County's 2028 vision statement that calls for an effort to build desirable communities, promote economic vitality, and achieve environmental sustainability, as well as to use technology for serving, working together, and transforming how the county leads. Supervisor Chris Swartz said the mining facility is not a part of the 2028 vision and said the project would be a giant energy hog for the environmental future. As the county moves forward toward renewable energy usage, residents seconded his worries. Quote, I'm concerned that you're opening up Pandora's box by doing this, Glasner said. More precedents could be set that we might not be able to stop, unquote. Supervisor Linda Leyland said she voted no with her colleagues because the board usually supports the Planning and Zoning Commission, which has previously denied the request as well. The next story is filed by Courier staff. Courier's 8 over 80 award recipients are honored at a luncheon and award ceremony. Dateline Cedar Falls. Family and friends gathered Tuesday for a luncheon and award ceremony honoring the Courier's 2022 8 over 80 winners. This is our 13th class of honorees. These are individuals who have spent a lifetime making a difference in their communities as business and community leaders and volunteers. Their efforts, commitment, and dedication have inspired and motivated others. About 185 people gathered to see the latest group of recipients accept their honors. Janet Johnson, president of the North Iowa Media Group, which includes the Courier, welcomed the honorees and their guests to the event, which took place at the Diamond Event Center in Cedar Falls. Quote, this is now one of my favorite events. To hear what awesome things these seniors have accomplished with such humility is absolutely inspiring, Johnson said afterwards. Western Home Community's Chief Operating Officer, Jerry Harris, delivered opening remarks at the gathering. Enrique Oca, Director of Spiritual Care at Western Home Communities, delivered the opening prayer. Sponsors of the event included Western Home Communities, the Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa, and Cedar Valley Hospice. Now, here are this year's 8 over 80 recipients. Marlene Ben, 80, served for years on the Cedar Falls School Board, Family and Children's Council, and numerous philanthropic organizations. She and her husband, Park, were named Cedar Falls Representative Citizen of the Year in 1996 for extraordinary community involvement. Diana Blake, 80, began teaching music in 1965 at Waverly Shellrock Community Schools. She is a member of both the Cedar Falls and Waterloo Municipal Bands, director and member of the UNI New Horizons Band, and founded an area bassoon band. Eileen Cruz, 92, a retired registered nurse, created the first school nurse position at Ackley Geneva Schools, was a nurse supervisor for Hardin County Homemaker Health Aid Program, and began missionary work with the Partners of the Americas organization, traveling across the world on medical missions. Louise McGinnis, 84, worked as a nurse at Cedar Falls Lutheran Home, now New Aldeia Livescapes, earned a speech pathology degree from the University of Northern Iowa, and worked as a speech pathologist consultant for Head Start, AEA7, and the Franklin, Butler, Bremer Counties Associations. She served 5 years on the Cedar Falls Planning and Zoning Commission. Niall McMartin, who soon turns 81, is a retired John Deere skilled tradesman and U.S. Air Force Vietnam veteran who has grown into one of the Buchanan County's leading conservationists. He served on the Buchanan County Conservation Board for 10 years and previously worked with Iowa State University Extension after retiring from Deere 27 years ago. Paul Ryder, 81, taught chemistry for more than 41 years at the University of Northern Iowa and served as assistant provost. A self-taught musician who plays 20 instruments, Ryder was a driving force behind the Cedar Basin Jazz Festival and leads the Saints Dixieland Jazz Band. Joan Stigler, 83, graduated at age 52 from Upper Iowa University with a bachelor's degree in social work. She mentored teen parents and children in the juvenile probation system and volunteered in schools with low-income and at-risk students. She also chaired the Blackhawk County Board of Health. And lastly, Lois Wischmeyer, 92, has volunteered at Satori Memorial Hospital, now Mercy One, and at the Cedar Falls Tourism and Visitors Bureau for the past 15 years. In 2020, she received the Mayor's Volunteer Award for commitment to her community. Now, the Associated Press filed this last story on the front page. 8. Trump dismissed January 6 threats. And it begins with a photograph of Cassidy Hutchinson testifying before the committee. Washington. Former President Donald Trump fought security officials for control of the presidential SUV as he struggled to get to the Capitol building, the January 6, 2021 insurrection. A key former White House aide told House investigators Tuesday, even after he was told that some of his supporters were armed. Trump said that the protesters were not here to hurt me, recalled Cassidy Hutchinson, testifying before the House panel investigating the insurrection. Told by security officials that it wasn't safe to go to the Capitol after he addressed his supporters, Trump lunged toward the steering wheel of the armored vehicle, she said. The former aide said she was told of the altercation in the SUV, dubbed the Beast, immediately afterward by White House security officials, and that Bobby Engel, the head of the detail, was in the room and he didn't dispute the account. Engel grabbed Trump's arm to prevent him from gaining control of the armored vehicle, she was told, and Trump then used his free hand to lunge at Engel. Hutchinson, 25, then a special assistant to the White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, described chaos inside and outside of the White House that day as hundreds of Trump's supporters marched toward the Capitol, shouting the president's false claims of widespread fraud in the 2020 election. Aides inside the executive mansion, several of whom were warned of violence beforehand, became increasingly alarmed as rioters at the Capitol overran police, broke through windows and doors, and interrupted the certification of Joe Biden's win. Trump was less concerned, even as he heard there were cries in the crowd to, quote, hang Mike Pence, unquote. Hutchinson recalled that Meadows told aides that Trump thinks Mike deserves it. The president tweeted during the attack that Pence didn't have the courage to object to Biden's win as he presided over the joint session of Congress. As for the rioters, Meadows said, Trump doesn't think they're doing anything wrong. Hutchinson told the panel the former president was informed early in the day that some of the protesters in the crowd outside the White House had weapons, but he told officials to remove metal detectors to, quote, let my people in, and marched to the Capitol. Hutchinson's explosive testimony, featured in a surprise hearing announced just 24 hours earlier, came at the latest of the sessions the House Committee investigating the Capitol insurrection is conducting to inform the public about what happened as Trump's supporters broke into the Capitol and sent lawmakers running from the House and Senate. Quote, "As an American, I was disgusted," Hutchinson told the committee, reacting to Trump's tweet about Pence. "It was unpatriotic. It was un-American. And you were watching the Capitol building get defaced over a lie," unquote. Quote, "I still struggle to work through the emotions of that," she said. Members of the panel praised Hutchinson's bravery for testifying and said that some witnesses were intimidated not to cooperate. Quote, "I want all Americans to know that what Ms. Hutchinson has done today is not easy," said Wyoming Representative Liz Cheney, a Republican who led questioning at the hearing. Hutchinson depicted a president flailing in anger and prone to violent outbursts as the window to overturn his election loss closed. Some aides sought to rein in his impulses, some did not. At one point, Hutchinson said, the White House counsel Pat Cipollone barreled down the hallway and confronted Meadows about the fact that rioters had breached the Capitol. Meadows, staring at his phone, told the White House lawyer that Trump didn't want to do anything. An exasperated Cipollone said that blood would be on Meadows' hands if nothing were done, she said. Earlier, Cipollone had worried out loud that we're going to get charged with every crime imaginable if Trump went to the Capitol, as the mob of his supporters were breaking in. But there were conversations about him, quote, going into the House chamber at one point, Hutchinson said. Hutchinson quoted Trump as directing his staff in profane terms to take away the metal-detecting magnetometers that he thought would slow down supporters who were gathering for his speech that morning on the Ellipse in back of the White House. In a clip of an earlier closed-door interview with the committee, she recalled that the president saying words to the effect of, "I don't effing care that they have weapons," unquote. Before the crowd left for the Capitol, Hutchinson said she received an angry call from House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy, who just heard the president say he was coming. Quote, "Don't come up here," McCarthy told her before hanging up. In the days before the attack, Hutchinson said she was scared and nervous for what could happen. After conversations with Trump lawyer Rudy Giuliani, Meadows, and others, Meadows told Hutchinson that things might get real, real bad, she said. Giuliani told her it was going to be a great day and we're going to the Capitol, unquote. As a White House insider, Hutchinson told stories of a raging president who was unable to acknowledge his defeat. At the beginning of December, she said, she heard noise inside the White House around the time an Associated Press article was published in which Attorney General William Barr said the Justice Department had not found evidence of voter fraud that could have affected the election outcome. She said she entered a room and noticed ketchup dripping down a wall and broken porcelain. The president, it turned out, threw his lunch at the wall in disgust over the article, and she was urged to steer clear of him. Trump denied much of what Hutchinson said on his social media platform, ironically named Truth Social, including that he tried to grab the steering wheel of the presidential SUV, or that he said Mike Pence deserved to be hung. Quote, "I hardly know who this person, Cassidy Hutchinson, is," Trump wrote, calling her a total phony and bad news. Now we turn the page to the Cedar Valley section, and the first story is titled, Marlene Bend, Duty, Honor, Service is a Family Affair. This story was submitted by Pat Kinney. Cedar Falls. Her dad did business all over the state. His dad was the mayor. Public life was second nature to Marlene Benn and her late husband, Park Benn. So were their years of service. She on the Cedar Falls Board of Education, he on the boards of local hospitals. That service to community led to support in tough times. During the death of a child and Park's own illness and death a decade ago, that service also led to a surviving child to a career of service in her country in the U.S. Army. Marlene Benn, 80, is now receiving the rewards of a lifetime of service as recognized by her 8 over 80 honor. Born in Sheldon in a far northwest Iowa, quote, "We moved 7 times in 10 years," she said. Quote, "My father was a station hog buyer for Armor and Company, and so they were opening buying stations throughout the state of Iowa. He was a great guy, outgoing. Quote, "We were always involved in our community and church, so I learned civic responsibility from a very early age. My mother had to suffer because we 3 girls always thought our life would come to an end every time we had to move. That forced them to make new friends, and it worked," she said. "And we were always involved at school activities. The family ended up in Monticello in Jones County in east central Iowa. Quote, "That's where Park and I met. I was a sophomore and he was a junior. He'd lived there most of his life," unquote. Park went to Cedar Falls and the State College of Iowa, now the University of Northern Iowa. Ben went to Drake University in Des Moines and transferred to the University of Iowa, where she became a drummer in the university's renowned Scottish Highlanders Pipe and Drum Marching Band. But they kept up their courtship. Ultimately, they wed in June 1964. She taught school in Waterloo, and Park was selling insurance. Then Park shifted gears and went to J.S. Latta Company, where he met Harry, known as Bud Grant. Together, they helped co-found Professional Office Services in 1970. After 5 years of teaching at Old Orange High School, Ben decided to stay home, and the couple started a family, adopting a son, Brock. Shortly after, daughter Beth was born. Ben became active in Junior League, which was a gateway to broader community involvement. Quote, "I think the training they, the Junior League, provided young women was excellent," she said. "I got involved with public affairs. I liked that." She first ran for Cedar Falls School Board in 1977, when their children were in kindergarten and second grade. Quote, "Park and I always felt a sense of civic responsibility," she said. Quote, "His dad was mayor of Monticello at one time. My parents, even though we moved often, were always involved in the community and the church. They were great role models." Quote, "I always kind of thought I would run for school board," she said. "Joy Corning was a great role model for me." Corning, then school board president, would go on to serve as an Iowa state senator and lieutenant governor. Another mentor was Peg Anderson, who gave up her school board seat to unsuccessfully run for mayor. Ben succeeded her on the board. When Corning was elected to Iowa Senate in 1984, Ben succeeded her as school board president. In the meantime, Park served on and chaired both the Satori Memorial Hospital and Covenant Health System boards, and served on the Wheaton Franciscan Healthcare Board. He was instrumental in Satori's affiliation with Covenant Medical Center in Waterloo, both part of the Wheaton Franciscan system, and now all part of the Mercy One Network in Des Moines. He also was president of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Symphony Board and part of the committee which oversaw construction of the Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. Park and Marlene Benn were named Cedar Falls Representative Citizens of the Year in 1996 for extraordinary community involvement. Throughout her board service, there were always challenges, usually involving changes in where children attended school. One of the first big decisions was closing the Humbert Elementary School and converting it into the district's present administrative service center. Quote, "There have been several times in my volunteer career that I found myself in situations that were controversial," Marlene said. Quote, "But again, I always felt that I was working with strong leaders and we did our research and made decisions we thought would benefit the community and the organization." Ben also was involved with social service agencies, including Family and Children's Council and philanthropic organizations like Community Foundation of Northeast Iowa. Quote, "I just feel fortunate I've been able to work with so many wonderful people and learned from people and been acquainted with a lot of friends, she said. Those friends were a source of support when times got tough in 1990. Their son, Brock, died of a chronic heart condition at their Minnesota Lake home at the age of 20. It was a few months after Park had a heart attack and bypass surgery. Ben's mother had died a short time before Brock's passing. Quote, "It was the 6 months from hell," Ben said. "It was a terrible time," unquote. But doors opened about the same time. Daughter Beth left for the United States Military Academy at West Point, New York, and Ben had accepted a district sales leadership position with the Doncaster Women's Clothing Company. Park passed away in 2011, but lived to see Beth advance in her Army career through her various commands, including 2 tours in Iraq and 1 in Afghanistan, and began a family. Beth and her spouse, Dr. Julie Chappie, have 2 children, Park, 15, and Twyla, 12. Ben also gets periodic tours of duty, too, as a grandma. Yet another reward for a tradition of service and devotion to family as well as community. Listeners, you are listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls, The Courier, for Wednesday, June 29th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Robert C. Hoptley. Bob waited patiently outside the pearly gates of heaven with anticipation of seeing his Father God, his Savior Jesus Christ, and his guide and comforter, the Holy Spirit. When God did roll call on Saturday, June 25th, 2022, and called out the name Robert C. Hoptley, Bob, with ecstatic joy, raised his arms and yelled, "Here I am, Lord, I'm coming." He did his little wiggle dance and ran toward the gates of heaven. Bob joined his earthly parents, Carol Edwin Hoptley and Eileen Merle Newsom Smith Hoptley, along with his stepmother, Alice, known as Sal Hoptley, who, like 75 years ago, with anticipation and joy, waited for his arrival, along with his paternal grandparents, John Hoptley and Beatrice Gately Hoptley, and maternal grandparents, Henry Richard Smith and Daisy Dale Newsom. Beautiful great-granddaughter, Grace Violet Trimmer Humphrey, stepmother, Alice Jean Shimp Bartholomew, and stepbrother Jim, spouse Lisa Bartholomew. Bob graduated from Dunkerton High School in 1965, where he excelled in sports and academics, and then attended Morningside College in Sioux City, Iowa. He married Marie Paustates, and they welcomed 3 daughters and later divorced. He married Denise Gossman and later divorced. On February 4th, 1974, Bob walked into the Dunkerton Baptist Church, interrupted the pastor's sermon, and said, "I have to get saved right now. I can't wait. I can't do life like this anymore." From that day forward, he followed Jesus, his Savior and Lord, never looking back, but striving for the prize, entering into God's presence. He prayed, read the Bible, and studied God's Word every day and lived it. Bob was an entrepreneur who believed in working like you were working for Jesus, with passion, love, and correctly. He believed if you were honest, had integrity, studied and learned, and did the hard stuff, you would succeed at whatever you chose to do. Bob always rose above life's challenges, was responsible, stood up to bullies, and would protect the vulnerable. He was never wrong and would never back down when he knew he was right. His actions determined who he was. Growing up in the construction business, Bob acquired knowledge and skills, which he perfected and continued to use throughout his life. He gave his time, talents, and finances to help individuals, missionaries, churches, organizations, as well as individuals. When Habitat for Humanity hired him to oversee the home for a family in Cedar Falls, Bob was told it would take a year to build. He said, "No, they'll move in 4 months." Spending countless hours from sunrise to midnight, using his own finances, adding and improving the layout and amenities, the family moved into the house in 4 months. The father, who bought the home, still calls to say thank you for his beautiful home. Bob married Isyong Traffenstead Nort Hopley on July 29, 2000, at Niagara Falls, Buffalo, New York. Song was the love of his life, soulmate, partner, and best friend. Together, they showed everyone around them the definition of love and commitment. When life gets difficult, you don't give up the person you love and marry, ever. Although Bob was already ordained by God, he was ordained by the National Christian Church as a minister in 2014. Together, he and Song founded Overcomers International Ministries, preaching the message of hope, love, and salvation to those who God placed in their paths. They loved serving together as missionaries, locally and internationally. He leaves a lasting legacy in Costa Rica, India, Mongolia, Nicaragua, Panama, Russia, and the USA. One of Bob's passions for God was the prisoners in Fort Dodge and Mitchellville, where he faithfully served. A visitation and service at Cedar Valley Church, 3520 Ansboro Avenue in Waterloo, Iowa. Visitation is Friday, July 1st, 2022, from 4 to 7 p.m., and Saturday, July 2nd, 2022, at 10 o'clock a.m. Services will be at 11 o'clock a.m. at the church, with interment at Fairview Cemetery in Dunkerton to follow. Always trying to find a way to serve God, even in his final days, Bob requested no flowers, only memorials directed to Cedar Valley Church for missions or Overcomers International Ministries for prison and mission ministries. May you be blessed as you seek, know, love, and serve Christ as Bob did. Bob said read James 4:7 in the Bible, and he'll see you later. Lock at Tower Park is assisting the family. Online condolences may be expressed at www.lockfuneralservices.com. Carolyn M. Schmidt, Gilbertville. Carolyn M. Schmidt, 79 years old, of rural Waterloo, Iowa, died Monday, June 27, 2022, at the Cedar Valley Hospice House in Waterloo. Funeral services will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday, June 30, 2022, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, Gilbertville, with burial at St. Mary's Catholic Cemetery, Gilbertville. Visitation will be from 3 o'clock p.m. to 7 o'clock p.m. Wednesday at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Gilbertville, where there will be a rosary led by the Catholic Order of Foresters at 4 o'clock p.m. Visitation Wednesday will conclude with a vigil service at 7 o'clock p.m. The casket will also be open for an hour before services Thursday at the church. Memorials may be directed to Immaculate Conception Church, the Bosco Catholic School System in Gilbertville, and Cedar Valley Hospice in Waterloo. Online condolences may be posted online at www.white-mthope.com. Carolyn Margaret Becker Schmidt was born in Blackhawk County, Iowa, on December 18, 1942, the daughter of Christian Michael Becker and Ida Eva, maiden name Frost, Becker. Her desire was to become a nun, so after eighth grade, she went to Wheaton, Illinois, to further her studies with the Wheaton Franciscan Sisters. Eventually, she earned her nursing degree and decided to pursue that as a career instead. On May 23, 1970, she was united in marriage to Kenneth Nicholas Schmidt at St. Athanasius Catholic Church in Jessup, Iowa, and they made their home in Gilbertville, where they raised their family. Carolyn worked at Mercy Hospital in Cedar Rapids, St. Francis Hospital in Waterloo, and then for 26 years at Friendship Village in Waterloo. After retirement in 2011, she helped with the Don Bosco Scripp program and volunteered at Mercy One in Waterloo. Carolyn loved her church, her patients, and grandchildren. She enjoyed cheering for the Cubs, baking at home, and day trip excursions. She will also be remembered for her daily devotions and praying the rosary. White Funeral Home in Jessup, Iowa, is in charge of the arrangements. Here the courier lists 5 death notices. James Baldwin, 82, of Iowa Falls, died Monday, June 27, 2022, at Hospice of North Iowa in Mason City. Arrangements are with Council Woodley Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Iowa Falls. Kenneth Boyce, 75, of Waterloo, died Sunday, June 26, 2022, at Northcrest Specialty Care. Arrangements are with Locke Funeral Services. Diane D. Knopf, 67, of Boone, died Sunday, June 26, 2022, at her home in Boone. Arrangements are with Council Woodley Funeral Home. Evelyn L. Pilchard, 78, of Iowa Falls, died Monday, June 27, 2022, at Hospice of North Iowa in Mason City. Arrangements are with Council Woodley Funeral Home and Cremation Services of Iowa Falls. And Kathy Ann Rittenauer, 63, of Waterloo, died June 27, 2022, at the University of Iowa Hospital. Arrangements are with Parrot and Wood Chapel of Memories. And now we turn back to local news from the Courier. Vilsack announces $10 million Ag Waste Program grant. Story filed by Tom Barton of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Ellie. For U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, infrastructure is not just about investing in roads and bridges and broadband internet. It's also about investing in the future and inspiring innovation, he says. Like using corn to make yoga pants, or using anaerobic digestion on a cattle feedlot to break down manure and food waste into methane that can generate electricity. At an event Tuesday at Dam and Debbie's Creamery in Ely, the head of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and former Iowa governor announced funding for a program created under the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill signed into law by President Joe Biden. Quote, Dan and Debbie represent the many American farmers, families, and communities USDA is called to serve, Vilsack said. Quote, this pilot program is a critical part of USDA's commitment to enhancing the circular economy and providing additional revenue streams for farmers. This program will help farmers take field residues and waste products and turn them into value-added products that create wealth and drive economic development in rural areas, unquote. Under the program, the USDA will award up to $10 million divided among the highest-rated applications that include eligible universities and private sector partners. Vilsack said the initiative will help build a bio-based economy in America by finding ways to turn agriculture residue into products for consumers and construction. Quote, what does that mean? It means taking everything that's grown and raised and produced on a farm and turning it into something more valuable, Vilsack said. Quote, that includes not just the corn and soybeans, not just the livestock that can be processed, but also all of the waste product, unquote. He pointed to construction of a $300 million chemical plant in southeast Iowa's Eddyville that will use corn to make fabric and other materials. The project, a joint venture of Cargill and Helm, a chemical company based in Germany, will produce a chemical called Quira, developed from corn sugar instead of from fossil fuels, said Jill Zulo, managing director for biointermediates at Cargill. Quira can cut up to 93% of greenhouse gas emissions when compared to traditional fossil sources, according to Cargill. The chemical is used to manufacture spandex and athletic wear. Carbon dioxide trapped by corn creates starch. Sugars from the starch are then fermented into butanediol, with Quira being extracted, Zulo said. The facility is being built on Cargill's existing Eddyville campus and is scheduled to open in the summer of 2024. Quote, we would sell Quira to the spandex maker, and then that spandex maker sells it to Nike, Under Armour, Zulu said. Vilsack said investment is part of the Biden administration's ongoing work to create good-paying jobs, lower greenhouse gas emissions, and boost economic opportunities in rural communities. After getting the initial grant and once equipped with a roadmap for how to create a bio-based product that can become a consumer product or construction material, Vilsack said applicants can then tap into and more easily navigate existing grant and loan assistance programs through the USDA and the infrastructure bill in the hopes of accelerating climate-smart agriculture practices like those of Brian Sievers. Sievers owns and manages a beef cattle feedlot in Stockton outside of Davenport, looking to expand his feeding operation, but wanting to do so in a very sustainable fashion. Sievers built an anaerobic digester in 2013 with the help of a $500,000 grant through the USDA. He also received a USDA Environmental Quality Initiatives Program and an energy grant through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Sievers said the farm generates enough electricity from methane produced from the digester, which it sells to Alliant Energy, to power 1,000 homes. Quote, it's really meant a way for us to grow our beef cattle industry in a way that reduces our carbon footprint, Sievers said. We just think it's an excellent opportunity to manage our risk in our farming operation and create another way to generate cash flow in ways we think are very sustainable, unquote. Sievers said methane produced by the digester has provided a steady stream of revenue to buffer against volatile commodity prices. Quote, profitability in cattle feeding can be very cyclical, he said. You can lose a lot of money. You can make a lot of money. Cattle profits are going to come and go, but they're going to defecate every single day, unquote. Sievers said the business is now looking at expanding its digester facility to produce renewable natural gas that would be injected into a pipeline and turned into compressed or liquid natural gas to be used as transportation fuel. Quote, a program like this will help us look down the road and potentially expand, he said, and hopefully other facilities will be able to come in and do the same kinds of things we've been doing in our farming operation for the last 9 years, unquote. Our next story was written by Jeff Reinitz. Deputies find lost CR fisherman, arrest him. Dateline Brandon. There was good news and bad news for Cedar Rapids fisherman Tuesday after he got lost in the woods outside of Brandon. The good news, authorities found him. The bad news, authorities found him. Shortly after deputies with the Buchanan County Sheriff's Office guided 32-year-old Garrett Wayne Spence to safety with the help of a drone and a police dog, they arrested the man on an outstanding warrant from Linn County for third-degree sexual abuse. He was taken to the Linn County Jail in Cedar Rapids, and bond was set at $25,000. According to Buchanan deputies, Spence called 911 around 12:30 a.m. Tuesday to report that he was lost in the dark in a wooded area near Courtney Pond in Hoffman Woods. His phone battery was almost drained, so he lit a fire near a creek to help rescue workers locate him. Deputies went to the area, located in the 1600 block of the 330th Street near Interstate 380, and used a drone equipped with a forward-looking infrared camera to lock in on the campfire. Deputies then used the drone's searchlight and loudspeaker in an attempt to direct him back to the roadway. When that didn't work, the officers used K-9 Coda and an infrared camera to enter the woods and locate Spence, who was tired but otherwise uninjured. Next, this story also by Jeff Reinitz. Police recover stolen gun and drugs during a traffic stop. Waterloo. Waterloo police seized a stolen gun and drugs during a traffic stop. Officers arrested passenger Keegan Glenn Greenwood, 18, for trafficking stolen weapons, fourth-degree theft, and carrying weapons. bond was set at $5,000. The driver, 32-year-old David Lorenzo Ritchie, was arrested for possession of ecstasy with intent to deliver. His bond was set at $25,000. Officers pulled over a Ford Expedition in the area of Congress Street and Logan Avenue around 1:10 p.m. Friday. Greenwood was carrying a loaded 9mm Taurus handgun in his pants pocket, court records state. Police determined the weapon had been reported stolen. Police found a bottle of MDMA pills in the vehicle's center console. Court records show Ritchie had been shot in the hand during an apparent robbery attempt around 1:30 a.m., May 13th, in the 400 block of Sunnyside Avenue. Next, teen arrested for third gun in less than a year. Story filed by Jeff Reinitz, Waterloo. A Waterloo teen has been arrested on gun charges while awaiting trial for two other incidents where he was found with guns this year. Police arrested Rob Marciano Omarion Robinson, 17, on Thursday for felon in possession of a firearm. He is charged as an adult, according to court records. Bond was set at $50,000. He was also detained on pretrial violations. Officers with the police department's violent crime apprehension team spotted a person with warrants in the area of Charles and Lynn Streets around 4:55 p.m. Thursday. Robinson was standing near him. When the teen saw officers, he dropped a satchel he was carrying and walked away, court records state. Police found a loaded 9mm Taurus handgun inside the satchel. At the time, Robinson was out on bond from an April 25th incident where police executed a search warrant at 121 Wellington Street and found digital evidence that he possessed a 9mm Glock Model 26. He was also awaiting trial in a February incident where police found Robinson sitting in a parked car with a 9mm Glock Model 17 in his lap. Now we turn to the sports page. The Wolverines sweep Columbus and win the NICL Central Crown. Story filed by Ethan Petrick, Dateline Waterloo. The Dyke New Hartford baseball team clinched the North Iowa Cedar League Central Division title with wins of 8-0 and 14-4 over the Columbus Catholic Sailors on Monday. A perfect 12-0 in the conference slate, the 21-1 Wolverines needed just one win during a Monday night doubleheader against the 17-8 Sailors, who trailed Dyke New Hartford by two games for the division lead. According to DNH junior Gus Varney, the Wolverines set out at the beginning of the season to nab the division title, among other goals. Quote, "That was one of our first goals of the season," Varney said, "but there is still a lot of work to do for postseason," unquote. In the first game, Wolverines looked to accomplish that goal by jumping out to an early lead. With three hits in the top of the first, DNH took a 2-0 lead. Over the final six innings of action, DNH added six more runs while holding Columbus to just two hits to clinch the division with an 8-0 victory. According to the Wolverines head coach Jordan Martin, DNH accomplished their goal because of their hard work throughout the season. Quote, "The kids battled all year," Martin said. "The way they have worked and battled throughout our games, they deserve it," unquote. In the second game, the Wolverines' offense continued to hum while the Sailors also found a rhythm at the plate. After Devon Kalish put DNH in front with a 1-0 on a wild pitch, Columbus's offense came alive in the first inning with one run on three doubles from Thomas Steele, Nick Merrifield, and Connor Knudsen. Riding the momentum from their big first inning, the Sailors took their first lead of the night at the bottom of the second. Jake Bradley reached first via a walk and scored on a DNH error to put Columbus on top at 2-1. After a scoreless third inning, the Sailors took a 3-1 lead when senior Caden Hartz scored from third on a wild pitch. After recording only two hits in the contest through four innings, the Wolverines doubled their output at the plate with two hits and regained the advantage. Trailing 4-3, the Sailors managed to tie the game 4-4 as Knutson drilled an RBI double to score senior Carter Gallagher from first. However, DNH took over the game with three runs on three hits as junior third baseman Will Texter, junior catcher Nick Reinecke, and Varney all recorded RBIs. DNH further ensured their victory with seven more runs on the top of the seventh to win 14-4 and finish the season a perfect 3-0 against the Sailors. In the doubleheader, Varney went 5-for-10 at the plate with one double and two RBIs. In addition, Reinecke went 4-for-8 with a double and an RBI. Texter pitched the shutout in the first game for the Wolverines, allowing only two hits and no walks. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, June 29th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thank you for listening to Your Iris, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.